Welcome to the deep dive. You know that feeling? That little protective twinge you get sometimes in close relationships, like something precious belongs just to you.
Oh yeah, that protective instinct. It's a really powerful thing.
This chapter on jealousy, it's really got me thinking.
We're focusing on chapter 5 of Unraveling the Fabric of Fear. The title is pretty direct: Jealousy, the Desire to Control.
Right.
And our mission here is basically to unpack the core ideas in this chapter, really get to the bottom of what it suggests is driving this powerful emotion.
And it throws a bit of a curveball right from the start, doesn't it?
We always think of jealousy as like, proof of passionate love. But this chapter, it kind of turns that whole idea upside down.
It really does. Like, remember those old movies?
Yeah.
Where someone would be like, oh, you're just jealous because you love me so much?
Right. But this book's saying, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Not so fast.
Exactly. The author's arguing that jealousy, it's not actually about love at all, but instead it comes from something much deeper and a lot more, honestly, unsettling.
Fear.
Fear. Okay, now I'm really interested. What kind of fear are we talking about?
We humans are like hardwired to want to be accepted. You know, we talked about this before with the macaque monkeys, right?
Right.
And how their dopamine levels went up and down based on like where they thought they stood in the group.
Right, right. It's like our brains are always checking to see if we're, you know, measuring up.
And these tricky behaviors like jealousy aren't necessarily who we are, but patterns we've learned along the way.
Okay, so let's start with the basics then. How does this book actually define jealousy? What are we talking about here?
It's defined as the fear of displacement or loss relating to what we believe we already possess or have rights to.
Okay, so that belief part seems important. The feeling you already have a claim.
Exactly. It hinges on that sense of entitlement. Then there's covetousness.
How's that different?
Well, that's the desire to possess anything, which we believe is both currently unattainable and is a possession of someone else.
So wanting what someone else has and feeling like you can't get it.
Right. And then envy takes it a step further. It's covetousness plus hatred, resentment towards the perceived owner.
Oof. So it's not just wanting it, it's actively disliking the person who has it.
Much more negative, more corrosive, you know?
Yeah, definitely sounds it. So jealousy is about holding on. Envy and covetousness are about wanting what someone else has, with envy having that bitter edge.
But the chapter's key insight, the real takeaway here, is that all three are deeply, deeply connected to how we perceive our social standing, our value in the group. Jealousy isn't necessarily about the actual intrinsic worth of the thing we fear losing. It's about its perceived power to grant us social standing. And that hits us right where we live, in our sense of self-worth.
So we see these things, relationships, attention, maybe even possessions, as props. Things that hold up how we feel about ourselves compared to others.
That's a good way to put it. Props for our self-esteem, mediated through social value.
It's less about the person or the object, and more about trying to control that external stamp of approval, that source of social value we think boosts us up.
We fall into this trap of thinking that if we can just control the things that give us social value, then we'll be safe. So we try to possess them. And the chapter then looks at a pretty, well, unhealthy behavior that can spin out from this. Intentionally trying to make other people jealous.
Yeah. Why would someone do that?
It's explained as a really twisted way to get validation. If the other person reacts with jealousy, it temporarily proves to the manipulator that they are valued, that the other person fears losing them.
Ugh. So it boosts their ego by playing on someone else's insecurity.
Exactly. But the chapter stresses how damaging and, frankly, combative that is. It's not healthy reassurance.
Not at all. A zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
It's also mentioned, just briefly, how marketing taps into this, right? Encouraging envy, making us feel we need to keep up.
Yeah, it just shows how deep these feelings run and how easily they can be exploited.
How does that work? Like, what goes on behind the scenes?
Well, think about it. We're constantly bombarded with messages about what we should have, how we should look, who we should be to be happy. And guess what? A lot of those messages are designed to, you know, play on our insecurities, like our fear of not being good enough.
So they're using our jealousy to sell us stuff, make us feel like we need that new phone or that perfect body to fit in.
Exactly. It's subtle, but it works. They're really good at creating the sense of scarcity, exclusivity, like, you know, fear of missing out. Think of those limited edition things or those members only clubs. They prey on our desire to belong, to be part of something special. And don't forget about social media. Everyone's always showing their best selves, their perfect lives. It's like a breeding ground for comparison, you know. It makes you question your own worth. It makes you want to have more, be more, all for that, like social validation.
Yeah, it's like they're giving us a blueprint for social value. And if we don't match up, we feel like we're failures. It's exhausting.
It's like there's this checklist for a good life, and we're always trying to check off all the boxes.
That's so true.
The chapter talks about feeling jealous when someone else gets attention. Even about attention given to pets. If you somehow believe that attention gives the other person social points, you're missing out on.
Wow, even pets, even video games. How do video games fit in?
Well, think about it. Many games have leaderboards, achievements, recognition within the games community. It creates a mini social hierarchy. So feeling jealous of someone's high score isn't really about the score itself. It's about that perceived social standing within that specific context. It taps into that need for validation.
Okay, I see the connection now. This is where it gets really crucial, I think. This need for social value, for self-worth. How does that translate into wanting to control people?
Yeah.
Especially partners.
Well, it connects back to the source. If you see your partner's attention, their affection, as a primary source of your own social value and self-worth, then when that attention seems to go elsewhere, it feels like a direct hit to your worth. It creates this feeling of a lack of control over your own standing.
And that lack of control feels bad, so you try to regain it.
Precisely. The reaction can be to try and control the source of that value, meaning try and control your partner's attention or even them.
So that jealous pang when my partner connects with someone else, it could be my subconscious basically screaming, warning, social value dropping.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. That fear of loss, that fear of losing what feels like yours can escalate.
Into wanting to possess their attention, their time.
Exactly. Wanting to own and control that source to shore up your own feeling of worth, even if logically you know you don't own a person.
Monogamy. How does this structure, often idealized as total devotion, become fertile ground for ownership? It feels so contradictory.
It absolutely is a paradox, and the book really leans into that. The intention might be selfless devotion, truly.
Yeah, you go in thinking, I want to give myself to this person.
But relationships evolve, and naturally, expectations develop. You start expecting reciprocity, similar levels of attention, affection, commitment.
It becomes a kind of exchange, even if unspoken.
Right. And it's when there's a mismatch, when you perceive that the reciprocity isn't there or isn't meeting your expectations.
That's the trigger point.
That's often when those feelings of loss and then the desire to control can really surface. The initial ideal of devotion gets overshadowed by the unmet expectation.
So you feel like you're losing out on your return on investment, emotionally speaking.
In a way, yes. Even if you believe in devotion without owning, the feeling of not getting back what you expect can activate those possessive controlling instincts. It's like trying to force the outcome you anticipated.
Wow. So the selfless idea can contain the seeds of its opposite if we're not careful about expectations.
Yeah. Which brings us to a really important counterpoint in the chapter. The idea that true love doesn't seek to control or own.
This feels like the way out, maybe. The antidote.
I think so. The chapter really argues that genuine love respects freedom, allows people to be themselves. Trying to possess someone actually undermines love.
It stifles them. And it mentions offering support only when it's welcomed.
And there's that really powerful quote in there, something like, if we need someone to change, then we don't love who they are. We love our own idea of who we think they should be.
Which means?
We just love ourselves, our own ideals, not the actual person. That's quite a challenging thought.
It really is. Makes you check your own motives. Are you loving the person or your fantasy of them? There's that proverb, too, about the flower.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one. Do you pick the flower you love to possess it, ultimately killing it and making it serve you?
Or do you just admire it, visit it, let it live and thrive?
It captures that difference beautifully. Possession versus appreciation.
Definitely a key insight. It reminds me of that saying, if you love something, let it go.
The chapter frames returned love as a bonus, a gift, not something you can demand. If you demand it, it becomes conditional.
Like a business transaction, as the chapter puts it.
Stark, but it makes the point.
Which brings us to a really profound potential takeaway here.
Go on.
If the main places you get your sense of social value from are things that can't really trigger jealousy or envy or covetousness, things like, say, your connection with nature or your own intellectual curiosity.
Things that aren't zero-sum games.
Right. Then you wouldn't feel threatened by others' games. you'd be immune to jealousy and envy.
That's the idea.
That's the implication. It raises a really important question for you listening right now. Where do you primarily get your sense of self-worth?
Is it from external stuff? Things that are easily compared or feel threatened? Or is it from more internal sources? Things less about competition, it's worth thinking about.
And the chapter pushes this even further, this whole idea of ownership. It argues that the only things we truly, truly own are our experiences and our intentions.
Everything else.
Everything else. Possessions, relationships.
We're custodians, maybe. We care for relationships. We participate in them. But we don't own them.
Even our own bodies, we're just temporary custodians of. We're looking after them for a while.
Shifting from owner to custodian is key. That perspective.
Yeah.
It really shifts things, doesn't it? If you take that on board.
Yeah, the whole basis for jealousy around stuff, or even people, starts to look pretty shaky.
It really does. And this ties back neatly to the preface of the book, remember?
How so?
Well, the preface introduced that spectrum, love at one end, fear at the other. And fear was linked to a desire for control.
Right.
Jealousy, when you look at it through this chapter's lens, this fear of losing value, this desire to possess and control it clearly sits way down towards the fear end of that spectrum.
Absolutely. Okay, so towards the end of chapter 5, the author brings in some religious perspectives, and they seem to echo these core themes.
They do. It's quite fascinating how different traditions seem to converge on similar ideas about this.
So let's touch on those. How do they align with the chapter's arguments and maybe that preface idea?
Okay, so starting with the Christian perspective mentioned, the chapter cites Proverbs 14:30, talking about envy rotting the bones, basically being self-destructive.
Okay.
And 1 Corinthians 13:4, the famous passage about love, explicitly says love does not envy. Other bits from Galatians and James are mentioned too, painting envy and selfish ambition as really negative, divisive forces.
And how does that link back?
Well, it connects directly to that preface idea. Behind every evil is a fear. Behind every fear is lack of understanding. Envy, from this view, seems to stem from a fear of lack, a failure to understand maybe your own value or God's provision.
Okay. What about the Muslim perspective?
The chapter references Quran 2.213. It talks about how jealousy and contention arose among people even after they had received clear guidance. It became a source of division.
So again, a similar theme.
Yeah, it links to that idea of ignorance or perhaps ego getting in the way of harmony. Jealousy, driven by a limited view or maybe a sense of scarcity, creates conflict.
Makes sense. And Buddhism, that seems like it would fit right in with the non-attachment idea.
Absolutely. It's highly relevant. The chapter brings up verses from the Dhammapada, plus quotes from Zen teachers. They all strongly emphasize letting go of the idea of ownership.
Overcoming envy.
Yes, overcoming envy and attachment as really essential steps for achieving peace of mind. It resonates powerfully with the preface's idea of balance, like yin and yang. Attachment and possessiveness throw you off balance. Letting go restores it.
In the Hindu perspective.
The chapter draws from the Bhagavad Gita. It highlights verses about being free from attachment, from longing, from envy. Achieving this freedom is seen as crucial for gaining peace and a steady mind, a clear intellect.
And how does that connect?
Well, think about the preface defining love partly as curiosity and fear as its opposite. Envy, attachment. These things cloud your mind, right? They block that open, curious engagement with reality. So letting them go allows for that clearer, more loving perspective. There are other spiritual perspectives mentioned too. Eckhart Tolle on thoughts creating unhappiness, not situations.
Right. Transcending the ego.
Yep.
And the Emerald Tablet suggesting everything is in flux, even ourselves. The Law of One talking about possessiveness, hindering compassion.
It all seems to point towards letting go of attachment and the illusion of control and ownership.
So when you pull it all together from this chapter, jealousy seems deeply connected to our sense of social value, triggering this desire to control things or people we think we own to protect that value.
Yeah, that's the core argument. But then you have this counter narrative, both from the chapter's analysis of love and from all these spiritual traditions.
Saying that real love is about freedom, not possession. And that letting go of attachment, recognizing ownership as maybe an illusion, is the path away from envy and jealousy towards peace.
It really brings us full circle to that initial definition, the fear of losing something you feel belongs to you. These traditions suggest maybe the solution is to question that feeling of belonging in the first place.
Which leaves us, and you listening, with something to think about, I suppose.
Definitely. Considering everything we've discussed, the illusion of ownership, the focus on non-attachment in so many wisdom traditions.
How might changing your perspective on what you actually truly possess affect how you experience jealousy?
It's a deep question, worth reflecting on how these ideas resonate with your own experiences.
Until next time, keep diving deep.